Good afternoon, everybody. I am very excited to welcome you all here. It's a beautiful day. Thank you for joining us. You are at Put the STEAM into STEM Education, Just Add Art, panel number 5718. We are in Eaton Humanities 150. My name is Alexis Halkovic, and the day is April 14th, Friday. My name is Alexis Halkovic. I will be moderating this panel. I am a social psychologist, so we're not really STEM.
You are.
Yeah, we fight. Psychologists fight to be involved in STEM. But I am also a lifelong learner and an educator, and I've worked with folks who've been incarcerated and who've worked really hard to get out of prison and get into college. And I view education as a means of personal transformation. I want to introduce our panelists very briefly, starting from next to me. Pooh Kay is a choreographer, a dance maker, and dance filmmaker, and very inspiring person. Heather Hansen, I just met, and has a beautiful piece of art hanging in Glenn Miller Ballroom, if you have not seen it. She does many forms of performance. Sydney Perkowitz is a polymath who integrates the sciences and arts beautifully, and I'm really looking forward to hearing about that. And Catherine Medler is a biologist and has been doing really interesting work around obesity and taste and the relationship with those. So we're going to start with short, about 7 minutes comments from each panelist, then we'll move into discussion amongst the panelists, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. And we are in a room that does not support texting, so if you would like to write down questions, we have folks walking around, Adam and Margaret, who can, if you raise your hand, they can give you a note card and a little pencil. All right, let's start with... We didn't
Me?
Decide who was going to start. You want to
start? Just start down there.
We have to hold the mic.
All right. Okay. I'm going to start. My name is Pooh, and I had to look up on the internet what STEM is and means. And it was interesting because I grew up in an age when we had something called SMSG, and also a similar system for reading. They were, what is it, integrated learning experiences. And I loved having this alternative way to learn. So I found this interesting that these ideas are being applied to the sciences. But the one thing that I noticed, and it was underlined when I had breakfast with my hosts, who all, both when I explained that STEM meant, said, "Where's the art?" So I am going to speak to the fact that I work with kids mostly now making cinematic productions. And so it's involved with the techniques of camera, the techniques of animation. And I have found that there are so many problems that they have to solve in order to do these, to do a complex project together that involve analytical thinking, involve inventing things. And it seemed to me when I read about STEM that if art were part of it, it would just be enhancing this idea of children being self-sufficient or learning how to act into the world as opposed to waiting to be told what to do. All right, that's fine.
Hi, my name is Heather Anson, and I am mainly an artist and a teacher, but I have a strange interest in science, like from a layman's perspective, I guess. I didn't get good grades, especially in math. I got better grades in every other subject, but somewhere along the lines around geometry, just after geometry, I kind of got lost. And part of what drew me to this panel discussion is that I feel like I actually have a gift for math, and it's coming out in my art. But I lack that solid, you know, education as far as algebra on. I got lost, and I think it had to do with, for me, the kind of learner I am, a kinetic learner. If there wasn't a practical application for me to understand, then I couldn't anchor those ideas. And I think art can be very useful in education by helping people connect emotionally to concepts and to give them little, you know, footholds or toeholds to hang on to ideas. I did want to say, there's this quote by Einstein that says, I wrote it down, I don't remember. The most beautiful and deepest experience a man can have is a sense of the mysterious. It is the underlying principle of religion as well as all serious endeavor in art and science. He who never had this experience seems to me, if not dead, then at least blind. And to me, that quote sums it all up. And I think the sense of the mysterious is something that drives curiosity and drives a desire to learn. And the more we can instill that in education, the better. So that's all.
Well, hi, everybody. I was the only one here for a while, so I'm really glad I have other people to share the light. I'm Sydney. The two people you heard from are artists. I'm more of a scientist, but I cross over to art a little bit, not as an artist, but as someone who wants to use art to broaden science. And one way I got into it was to write two books that combine art and science in different ways. One was called Empire of Light, and it's a book about how science connects to fine art. And one was called Hollywood Science, which was a book about how science connects, how science and science fiction connect to film. And if you're an academic, you know, once you write a book, then you can use it for a course. So that's what I did. So I taught courses based on both of those books. And I'll just tell you a little bit about the courses, not very much, but you'll get a taste of the kind of thing and how the science and the art interacted. In the course of Empire of Light, the first thing I had them do was look at cave paintings from Lascaux. These are caves in France where our ancient Neolithic ancestors painted images on the walls. This is 13 or 15 or 17,000 years ago. And the remarkable thing is that those images are still understandable to us. You know, they're animals, the colors are right, and so on. Is there any science in that? Absolutely. It says, for one thing, their visual system was not that different from ours. And even more important, when you look at a flat painting of a three-dimensional object and really know what it means, there's a lot of neural processing going on. So those people had similar neural processing to us. You really learn a scientific point from that. Another example, you can actually say something about quantum mechanics through art. One of the big difficulties in quantum mechanics is it seems to have two different kinds of physics happening in it. Electrons are either little billiard balls or something like waves. It's called the electron-wave duality. Mm. Well, the title of my book, Empire of Light, is a painting by a very well-known Belgian painter, René Magritte, who has a beautiful painting. It's in MoMA, New York. It's a painting of a regular city street, but half of it is in nighttime and half of it is in daylight. So that painting expresses the same paradox that quantum mechanics does. It doesn't teach you quantum mechanics, but it shows that this idea of bringing together two opposites has meaning in science and in art. I'll say a couple of words about my course about science and film, then I'll pass it on to Catherine. Science and film course, the idea was that we brought in students who were mostly not science majors. By the way, my courses were aimed mostly at non-science majors. These were not going to turn out people who were already scientists or engineers, although they were welcome. It was going to give people who would not be scientists or engineers a little flavor of what science is all about. Science and film course, we had 6 or 7 units. I taught it with a colleague in media studies. 6 or 7 units, nuclear energy, aliens, DNA, that kind of thing. And for each one of those, we found 1 or 2 films that illustrated the science. But before we showed them the film, we talked a little bit about the science. Then they saw the film. Then we asked them to critique the film. Did the film get the science right? And in critiquing it, they did another important thing, not just science, not just film, they had to write. See, this was really a triple-barreled course. I thought it was extremely successful, and the students loved it, that we always got more than we could handle who wanted to sign up for it. So those are just 2 examples of the way that I brought those 2 together and put the A into the S-T-E-M. And now I'll pass this on to Catherine.
So I'm an associate professor here in university, so I'm a research scientist, and I do have to do lecturing to graduate students and undergraduates. And certainly, we use art every day, right, because we're trying to explain really complex ideas and processes to students, and so every single thing has a picture with it. And so it's so much easier to understand something if you can visualize it and then somebody can walk you through, right? I could explain something to you right now that's not going to make a lot of sense, but if I had a cartoon where it would kind of illustrate it out. So I think art is in STEM, right? Just as it is in probably almost all kinds of education, right? Because it's much easier to illustrate a concept if you can have a picture and have someone explain to you what everything's going on in the picture. So I think it's already in there. And I think it's critical because science is so complex now. I mean, I won't speak to everything, but science is so complicated. And we know so much about how cells work, even though there's so much more we don't know. And so I just don't think it's possible to conceptualize it all without having a lot of illustrations associated with it. So yeah, I think it's pretty good.
Back to you.
I wanted to ask if any of the panelists have any questions or comments for each other.
Yes, I have a comment to make. So, Catherine, I agree with what you said. Science of illustration is really, really important.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of within science. There are people who are expert scientific illustrators. They do biology textbooks and botany textbooks and so on. Do you think there's value in what I try to do is connect to fine art, which is a different kind of art. Do you think there's value in trying to go outside just scientific illustration and making it culturally broader? That was kind of what I had in mind in my courses. Do you see a way to do that, or would show up in your courses?
So are you doing that to try to communicate science to the general public? I mean, what's the goal?
Two goals. To make it more comprehensible? Yeah, one way is to make it more comprehensible. Mm-hmm. If you look at those cave paintings, you get a certain emotional reaction, and then if on top of that you're saying that there's some neuroscience down in there, I think you have a great combination. The other point is to show that science is part of culture. It doesn't just stand off in a corner by itself.
Certainly.
In that STEM concept, I have to say I recoiled a little bit at the enormous emphasis in all the categories on being a useful citizen, of finding goals out in society to solve. I think it underestimated the learning and psychic growth that comes from the pursuit of an experience that is not tailored to be for somebody else. You know, I mean, the idea of designing a chair, well, that's great, but what if you designed a rocket ship out of washing machine parts? Or, you know, what if you did irrigation systems in a giant dirt hill? I did recoil a little bit. It felt very adult. It felt like, you know, you gotta eat your vegetables or else you're going to be a stunted human being. Anyway, I'm putting that in there for all of you STEM teachers. I'm sorry.
Yeah, just to reiterate kind of what you said, I think there's an emphasis on using art to teach science, not the other way around. When a lot of art can also be looked at scientifically, it's very interesting. Like when you see paintings that you can, there's a, what's the word, x-rays, and you can see all the layers that the artist did, building up to the one that you're familiar with. And there's ways of understanding art, and that says a lot about that artist's process, that they changed their mind all those times, or they went through this entire decision-making process to get to this certain landscape. And also science is explaining things that have been taught in philosophy and religion forever.
And could you get the mic right?
Yeah,
sorry,
stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, in some ways science is catching up to philosophy and religion and art, and other ways, you know, I think we're trying to help ourselves understand science, if that makes sense.
Yes. Well, I don't have another comment. I'm just holding the mic.
You have some questions.
Well, actually, maybe Pooh raised a question, you know. When you talk about STEM, there is kind of a built-in assumption, right, that the S, the T, the E, and the M come first, and the A is the add-on. I really think that's what you were saying. This is why it's hard to add the A, because unless you have a very liberal university, a very broad-minded university and broad-minded science department, the answer always is, well, it takes so much effort just to teach the science.
Yeah.
How do you add the art?
Yeah.
So the real problem is, how do you integrate them in a way that it seems natural, not just like an add-on, or at least that's part of it?
Well, I don't understand why they're not integrated.
Would you use the mic?
I'm sorry.
Okay. I guess I don't understand why they wouldn't naturally be integrated. I mean, the STEM descriptions I read were very focused on practical. A practical experience or applications of solving practical problems. And art is always presenting problems, sometimes impractical problems, not practical problems, that have to be solved. And it takes the same analytical and intellectual ability to do that. And I think I just don't understand, it's such an attractive, sexy thing to do. It's fun to make art. I don't understand why it wouldn't naturally be part of it anyway.
Okay, we have some questions. I don't know if this is any of our panelists' area of expertise, but video games are an underappreciated narrative and artistic medium. How can they be used to merge STEM, especially computer science and art?
I'm experimenting with VR right now, so it's not a kind of video games, but I'm using drawing programs that, so I can draw in a 3D space and myself just in a white grid. And by doing that, it's freed up my process so much. I feel like it's just an amazing feeling. It's magical. It's like I can draw three dimensions. I can draw sculpture, and I can dance sculpture. And when I first tried this technology out, it was about 6 months ago, and I didn't know anything about VR. But it was so exciting that I've just been obsessed for the last 6 months, just learning everything I can about it, getting the equipment, and I got a 3D printer, and printing my sculptures now. So I guess in that way, if you can engage an artist or a scientist in this crossover like that, it's really effective.
We're talking about kids.
The impetus to learn. But I mean, if you give a kid this program, they would just die. You know, it's like having a magic wand. It's crazy. Oh. So I mean, if I'm this excited about it, I can't imagine what an 8-year-old would do. Anybody else?
Yeah, there are a lot of things you can do. I was involved in a program that did all kinds of simulations on computers for college kids, but kids, older kids, to learn, to do some physics experiments. So, for instance, you could try to land a rocket ship. which is not an easy thing to do, landed in one piece by just manipulating your joystick and your control knobs. And then to really play with it, you could vary the gravity. So would it be harder to land on the moon or easier to land a rocket ship on the moon? Could you get a rocket ship off Jupiter or not? So what I'm trying to say is, once you get in that computer world, and I think it would be the same for an artist, it really breaks the universe open. You can change the parameters any way you want, experiment in different ways. If you don't like it, you don't even have to crumple up paper. You just clear the screen and you start all over again. So it's been a great learning tool. So if you want to use a very broad definition for video games, I think that's a tremendously good part of STEM and of art. Okay, yeah. We'll say it for all of them. Yeah. Okay.
But you're right, there's a lot of those programs that are available. I mean, I had a program 30 years ago, How an Action Potential Works, and you could modify all those things. Right. It was all done on the computer. We have teach labs because we've got 1,400 kids we're trying to teach in a semester, and half of them have a virtual lab, and so it's all virtual. So they're pipetting and doing all these things. So it's already, I mean, obviously the computer technology, it's already used quite a bit. And I think kids that grow up on video games are very comfortable with it, so then they can focus on the concepts of what they're trying to understand, and they're not going to get hung up on control and lead or whatever like I would do.
Oh, a gamer.
Right, next.
Okay. So I had a question, which was, can you think of ways that art might help facilitate critical thinking, or has helped to facilitate more deeper critical thinking among your students, or for yourself, or in your work, or in your teaching? Any of you?
There's always the experience of critique and problem solving, which ends up making you have to see different perspectives on what you're doing and look at what you have done somewhat from the outside. Is it successful or is it not successful? What would I have done to make this more successful? What will I do to change this? I think that it's very important to be able to I don't want to call it being self-critical, or to just, it's very important not to feel that every action you make is absolutist. And I've watched kids just solve difficult, you know, even politically or psychologically difficult situations, so that they could go forward with what they wanted to do in an art project. And I don't really think that's that different than what would happen in a group science project. But on the other hand, you know, kids who make robots, I know that there's a practical application of robots that are putting the world out of business, the humans out of business, but they are also an absolutely magical, extraordinary toy. And this program seems like it has that potential of merging the absurd, the unnecessary, and the magic of creation with skills that will be useful or can be applied more rigorously. Mm. Yeah.
I work with dancers a lot, and what's always striking to me is I feel like dancers are architects of space.
Yeah.
It's a little bit abstract if you're just watching it, but when you're doing it, you feel that geometry, you feel the physics. There's, you know, you're learning your spatial positions in a choreography, then you're learning dynamics like speed and force and tempo. And then on top of that, there's often, good choreography usually has some kind of philosophy behind it, so you're integrating, you know, concepts in addition to all this. That's all happening at once, and you're integrating it into your body. And I feel like it's a really powerful way to teach just about any idea. My series that I'm doing now has a lot to do with body geometry, and I I get a lot of letters from teachers that are using this to just teach their kids geometry, just basic geometry stuff. So they'll get them up to the chalkboard and use your arm like a compass, and they're just like, wow, okay, yeah, I get it, that's 90 degrees. So there's something to be said for that kind of integration.
Well, the example I would think of, it, I wouldn't say it's so much critical thinking, but it makes you think very broadly. And I think people alluded to it, if you had a design team that had some engineers in it and some aesthetics people, you could call them designers or artists, but something along those lines, and you asked them to produce a beautiful phone, you would have an iPhone or an iPad. You know, the reason people like Apple, one of the reasons, it's not just that the hardware works, it's just that it looks good and it feels good to hold. So there's been kind of a blending of aesthetics and engineering there. And I imagine, I've never done a design like that, but I imagine if you're part of a design team like that, you're doing a huge amount of weighing back and forth what you can squeeze in and still have it look good.
Yeah.
You have to make critical decisions. What can you leave out and still have it be workable? So that's kind of along the lines you're talking about, yeah. I would think. I would hope you'd agree, yeah.
Yeah.
No? Okay.
Well, you know what? I would like to ask a question of Catherine. I fully understand that actual sciences are extremely meticulous and rigorous and backed with an enormous amount of information that has to be integrated into every quest, new decision. When, for you, did you start acquiring the intellectual skills to do that?
When?
Yeah, when? At what point in your life were you starting to construct your brain towards a science brain?
Oh, by high school.
Okay.
Yeah, so... but, I mean, my entire life, you know, it's always, you know, you have science as you're going through elementary school, but I really focused in and decided that's what I was going to do forever in high school. Yeah. I'm not sure if you have some extra point in there that...
You know, where you take the step from it being a what you're doing in school and the pleasure you're having and what you're learning... to become a focused on a profession, to start saying, I'm not just doing this to play, or I have to think in a more scientific way, or I'm going to have to get more information.
So I guess you're kind of implying that it's not play, that it's not fun.
Well, I know
that
it's fun.
I don't absolutely adore my job and think I'm the luckiest person on the planet because... it's solving a puzzle every single day. I'm creating new knowledge. I'm finding out things that we didn't know before, and I'm adding to the space, and there's a lot of brilliant people doing that in a lot of different directions, and they're all, you know, it's amazing how creative some of those people are, the way they come up with some of these things that can change.
I wasn't saying it wasn't play. I just wanted to find you, just you need to say that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's just, you know, that's what I was drawn to. It's like, okay, so I eat this food and I digest it. How in the world does that work, right? That's like that's what drew me in. That's what I'm excited and trying to, like, how does that work? What is this doing? Why is our skin like this? Why is it this color? Why are our leaves green? You know, it's like there's an incredible amount of curiosity and creativity every day in all aspects of science. I mean, all those people see those little splits in space and they're like, oh my God, there's a whole solar system over there, right? It's like, how are they doing that, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of creativity that's kind of ingrained into it, and just you have to be creative to come up with new ideas.
New ideas, yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you know, that'd be a good question. Maybe we ought to ask all of us, at what age you decide you're going to be a scientist or an artist. My story is that by age 5 I knew I was going to be a scientist, and I cannot explain any of those, any origin. No one in my family is. In fact, I'm first generation of my family that even went to college.
Wow.
But it just popped out. And I believe a lot of artists would say the same thing, right?
Yeah.
They knew very early. It wasn't a matter of a certain amount of training. You just knew.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
No,
I don't think I'm wrong.
I have no idea.
It's just that. It sounds crazy, but...
Well, I had wanted to be a kid's book illustrator, and I think that's because I had, you know, I'd read every book in the library by the time I was 10 years old, and I wanted just more. I felt someone should just be making more. But I ended up having that coup de foudre, that falling in love experience as a young, in my early 20s, when I saw a woman crawl across the floor in a dance concert. And she was just crawling to get from A to B. She wasn't pretending to be anything. She wasn't pretending to have a beautiful shape. She just didn't feel like standing up. And this was so mind-blowing for me. I went back to my little art studio that I was renting, and I crawled steadily for 2 weeks trying to figure out why, like this hole that I fell into, like my heart fell into when I saw this. I mean, it finally occurred to me that I hadn't learned to walk till I was quite old, so I'd spent a lot of time crawling. But that, from that point onwards, I was not going to be making visual art. So anyway, you do have to fall in love.
There's a question. It's taking us in a little bit of a different direction. Do you think STEM is a fad, or will solve the problems of education deficiencies as we go into the future? What will we lose if art isn't taught as it is now, rather than absorbing it into STEM as quote unquote problem solving? What is art beyond problem solving?
That's three big questions.
Well, I think you could pick
anyone. Okay.
Pick any aspect of that you would like to respond to or that resonates with you.
Oh, I'm the chosen one. Okay.
Yeah, you're okay.
Okay. Well, I would like to deal with the first question. Do I think STEM is a fad? No, I don't think it's a fad. But I think it's such an easy, just for the reasons you guys have been saying, it has clearly laid out goals, and it can lead to a job.
Yeah.
It's so easy to grab a hold of that it just becomes a central theme.
Yeah.
It's not the answer to anything all by itself.
Yeah.
I was on another panel where we had to talk about could we possibly do better in the U.S. in math and reading, if you just want to get to basic intellectual skills. And as everyone here knows, the U.S. is pretty miserable on that. We're in the mid-range of best of all the advanced countries in the world. Yeah. So forget about learning a particular science like molecular biology.
Yeah.
Just getting six-year-old kids to read better, I don't think we're doing very well.
Yeah.
And STEM is not the answer to that. We need to dig much deeper, I think, to make that work right.
Yeah, it's the joy part of it.
So I think absolutely not. STEM is not a fad. It's not going anywhere. And I think that's where we're all moving. I absolutely don't think you need to put art and integrate it into STEM. I think it's its own thing, and I think it needs to stay its own thing, because I don't think everything needs to be a goal-oriented, we're going to make a better computer, or we're going to cure cancer, or we're going to do whatever. I think art is very important in our development. I think there's a lot of studies that people do art and music, that it trains different parts of your brain, and it actually makes you better able to learn other types of things. And so I don't think it's something that needs to get absorbed into something that's always, I mean, it has a goal, right? It's not maybe necessarily the same goal, but it certainly has its own goals, and I think it's very important to keep it in its own thing, that it doesn't have to be, I mean, it's all integrated. It all integrates, right? As you're talking about the geometry of movement and all that kind of, it all comes back and forth. But to say that we're just going to scoot art, whatever form of it, into STEM, I think that's not a good thing. Because I think it has its own value that's important to preserve in itself, right? That there doesn't have to be a goal, right? That your picture doesn't have to convey a message that I understand. Right? Necessarily. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're conveying something, but I'm going to get something else out of it. And I think that's a big part of our humanity. It's like, how long has art been around? Right? You're 15,000 years ago, people are putting art on the wall. It's just part of who we are as humans. And I don't think it's something that we want to get rid of. I certainly want my kids to be exposed to art and music and philosophy and other kinds of things, languages and stuff. I don't want them just doing STEM. And of course, none of them are doing STEM, but whatever.
Okay, your turn. There were two other questions.
What were the other two questions?
Of the What would we lose if art isn't taught as it is now, rather than observing into STEM as problem solving?
I mean, I don't think art is being taught adequately or included enough, so... Yeah, I don't think that we are teaching art well enough. And I lived in Paris for a few years before I moved here, and I just, it was very interesting. My son was I put him in school there, just in regular public school. And his education, especially in the arts and history, was just profoundly better than what he was getting here. Mm. And I mean, it's just clear that art is very important to that culture. But it made for very interesting conversation and very well-rounded people in general. That was my experience of that. And so just the idea that they need to be separated is silly to me. They're all separate subjects anyway. It's just included as an important aspect of this.
Or some education. Aspect of it. Yeah. You know, for me it's that usefulness, the STEM's emphasis on being useful. I have to say, if I were a child, I'd get tired of that. I mean, as a kid, I'd have my own ideas of what is useful, and it seems a very adult version of successful problem solving. That's all. That was my objection to reading about STEM online.
Okay. So I have a question. So acknowledging that doing scientific research is extremely creative work, as is creating art, can each of you describe your creative process as it relates to your work and maybe give a concrete example?
Say that again.
Okay, I'll repeat it. Can each of you describe your creative process as it relates to your work and give an example?
I just printed an example here, so I have one in my bag. I was talking earlier about my dance sculptures, and let me pull this out. So there's a print shop here at CU that does 3D printing, and I'm like, let's try this out. So they printed this last night.
I like that.
Yeah, so that's a series of gestures I did in dance.
Wow.
And now it's a sculpture.
They're gestures you would have done at different times, but now you made them all in one instant?
Yeah, it's a sequence of it was probably about 5 to 10 minutes worth of,
wow,
of movement that was trapped. So, I mean, that's a practical, that's a concrete example, but there was a lot of, there's been months of trial and error just trying to get something that would actually structurally hold up when it was printed. So, it's not just, moving around freely. It's like I'm building something, sculpting while dancing, and it's a really interesting problem for me to solve. That's my newest stuff.
my brush with technology is that I'm doing, I have this iPad, and the surface of a digital screen is so pleasant. It has no resistance. It's extraordinary to draw on. And I've been drawing on it and then animating the sketch. I'm doing animated sketchbooks. And it's the first time I've actually made something in a digital universe. And I wished I knew how to program. I wished I could get in and manipulate the machinery, but that's another lifetime. But at any rate, yes, and when I'm making dances, I do a lot of research work in the front. We really explore the physicality of a movement, and then we have to analyze it, because we'll have to take a movement apart and make it possible to repeat. And I think Yeah, the making of anything that involves several parts becomes a science-based exploration in some way. Anyway.
My creative process now is writing, so I don't have anything this interesting to show you. All I could show you would be a piece of paper. Maybe you would read the words on it. But it's really interesting that even writing has helped digitally, because my handwriting is very, very poor.
Yeah.
And it's slow. And I've written 8 books and about 150 articles because the computer lets me do that.
Yeah.
And lets me move ideas around, which is even more important. It's really, really the equivalent of what you can do in drawing, I think.
Yeah.
So that's a big part of it. The process itself is I get the germ of an idea, I put down some chaotic words on the computer screen. It's so far below a rough draft, you can't even call it a rough draft. It's just chaotic words. And then I keep refining.
Yeah.
Finally a piece comes out.
Yeah, so I think science is a bit like that, right? We start off with a question or an idea, and we propose a series of experiments that we then go and do. And based on that data that we get, then we decide, is that hypothesis correct? Or is there some caveats that we need to control for? And so, you know, we never know what the actual answer is going to be until we do the work. And then we look at the data, and then we have to figure out the data. I guess I do take a little bit of an exception with your definition, Pooh, of STEM being useful or practical, like adult, that's the goal of STEM. It's like, in reality, people that are doing science, we just want to know the answer.
Yeah, but when you read the text on the internet about STEM supporting it.
Well, right, because we want people to value it and understand it, and they can do that better if they have a practical application to their lives, right? I mean, but the reality, anyone that you would call a cancer biologist, they don't actually care about curing cancer. They want to figure out how cancer works.
Do it, right.
And then there's other people that can take that information and apply it to therapies and stuff. But you don't have a person studying cancer in a university or research center somewhere that's coming up with, I mean, they might try some different chemicals to see if it will reduce the proliferation of cells, but they're not actually doing therapeutics and putting together cures for people, right?
Yeah.
It's like, so we really care about just figuring out the answer, which is just curiosity, right? So
which is art.
Yeah, right. I mean, all of that. So, I guess that's what it doesn't. I think I'm answering the creative question. Hopefully.
I think you have. Yes. The essential.
I have a question for you. I'm curious about this. So, with the information that you have about taste, how does that affect you when you're at a fancy restaurant and try something new? Or, you know, do you think about it scientifically, or do you just enjoy the flavor?
No, usually it's just viscerally.
If I've got something really fantastic in front of me, then I just viscerally enjoy it. And I don't sit around and go, oh, that's very salty, oh, that's very sugary, other than the fact that I like to eat that. The only practical everyday types of things is that, you know, vegetables tend to be bitter, and kids overtly, you know, we avoid adverse compounds. But the flavor of the food's less intense if you hold their nose, so I would like hold my kid's nose to make them eat the vegetables. So that's like the real day applications that they were wish I didn't study taste.
So this is a question from a student. STEM gives us new opportunities to create art in new forms. Visual programming languages like processing. How can we encourage STEM students to use their skills in creative and artistic ways?
If I were teaching STEM, I would make that a project, final project. I guess it's just a point of view that would be incorporated in the curriculum, some kind of outcome-based that was valued, or had a value. I don't see why one couldn't apply it to doing video games or, you know, zines or whatever. You'd still be using, if you were doing computer sciences or design, but I'm not teaching STEM and I'm not planning these curriculums, so I'm going to just move this on.
I just read recently that Iceland has done away with subjects in their education system, which I think is fascinating. I don't know how you go about structuring anything without that, but you know, it's an interesting idea where everything is just integrated into this learning ball, I guess, you know. So I think the way you were teaching film from, like, well, let's analyze this, is the science good, or it's also involving writing and the artistic, that's a really interesting approach.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I would do, and I have done it, is a team effort, as Pooh said. So, particularly if you make the students produce, again, this is not fine art, but it's art. Can you produce a media work, maybe even some beautiful slides that illustrate a scientific idea?
Mm-hmm.
Do it as a team. And one thing, an idea I've had, I haven't done it, but other schools have, get a science major and an art major, one each.
To collaborate.
And have them each make one great poster. Mm. If they don't learn something from each other, I'm very, very much mistaken.
Yeah.
That'd be a great way
to go.
That's
a great
one. Yeah.
So I think the question was how to make them more creative in things like computer science or something, is that correct?
Yeah.
How to use their skills in creative and artistic ways.
So I think, I mean, I have really nothing to do with computer science, so I don't know in general. But I know my son is a freshman at Northeastern taking a computer science class, and it's like every week. That's what they do. They're given a go figure this out, and he spends a lot of time trying to figure it out because he's an English major and really is not really into computer science. But it's good. It's really stretching him, and he's really having to think very creatively and working really hard. But he doesn't know, right? There's not like we went over this in class. So here's your ABC. Go plug it in.
Mm-hmm.
It's like go figure out how to do this. And you know they're so yeah. I think. At least for that example, but that's what they do. And I think certainly in a lot of lab classes and stuff, you know, it's like you give them a general idea and in a pretty controlled environment in that case, because you've got chemicals and things where people can get hurt, that they have to go through the process and see if they can figure out the answer about whatever the question is. Yeah, I think there's some of that already.
You know, I had another thought while Catherine was talking. There's an opposite side to your question, can an artist make the scientist more creative? And that actually happened to me. I was an adjunct professor at Atlanta, had a College of Art, which is doesn't exist anymore. It's been taken over by another College of Art, but the original one, Atlanta College of Art. I was an adjunct professor, and I taught relativity to art majors, which was quite an experience.
That's amazing.
And the creative part was they would ask me questions that would just twist my brain. They ask such different questions because they're not in the science groove.
Yeah.
So the questions came to me out of left field. But I have tried to take them seriously and give them answers that made scientific sense and also made sense to them as artists. And boy, did I have to get creative. So that was quite an experience.
Do you have
experience
an example? Do you remember any?
Yes. One was, you know, in relativity, one of the things you observe is length contraction, which means if you're in a rocket ship and look through the porthole, everything seems shorter.
Yeah.
A meter stick is suddenly only an inch long. So one student asked me, is that really happen? Well, that's
really
a philosophical question.
Yeah.
You really need to think about that. And the best answer I could come up with is, we don't know if it really happens. The measurement says it's happened, but it happens, but we can't say any more than that. And that took quite a bit of thinking to come up with even a halfway decent answer. Does it really happen? Scientists wouldn't even ask that. They would accept that that's what relativity is supposed to be, right? It was in the textbook, so it must be right. And the artist just did an end run around that. He went right to the heart of it.
Is how actually real is science?
That's right.
So I had a question, I got a question for you, Sydney. Could you give an example of a film, book, or play that your students found scientifically accurate?
Yes, and it's a favorite film of mine. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was
eager to answer. This is a favorite film of mine, and I always title it whenever I can because it's not as well known as it deserves to be. It's called Gattaca.
Oh,
Any of you know this film? Oh, and we have a biology person here.
Well, I'm not part of it. I'm not.
Yeah. Okay. So it's set maybe 20 or 30 years in the future. It's like it's a society like ours, except genetic engineering is at the point where, for a couple of bucks, if you're dating someone for the first time, you can get their DNA analyzed and find out all about them. And even more important, for more money, for thousands of dollars, you can hire a geneticist to give your baby to be blue eyes or a higher IQ or better athletic ability.
Oh, okay. This is the big moral.
The big moral question. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it really paints the question of what this would do to a society. Now, there isn't a lot of science in it, but we're now at the point of genetic engineering where the broad strokes of what it talks about are real.
Yeah.
And not only I, but actually NASA once wrote a piece about it and said it's the most plausible science fiction film ever made. And that's one we had a lot of fun with our students. Yeah. The science, as far as it went, was accurate, and looking at what it did to society was really, really the important part of it.
Do you think genetics is the genie that was let out of the bottle?
Here's the person. I'm going to pass that one on.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. We had a panel the other day talking about biodesigning, babies or whatever, and if the technology's there, it is. It's gone. Yeah. There's no control.
There's no stopping it.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah. No. And it's like, maybe we can. The government in this country can control how. Like, we're not going to fund research that's going to do that kind of work. Yeah. But we can't control all the scientists in China and Europe and Asia, all of those.
Or
things.
The private corporations.
Oh,
right.
The private corporations, yeah. Yeah, you can't control those either. So it's definitely out of the bottle. Mm.
Okay. So I have a question. Can each of you, or any of you, think of a situation when your teaching made you rethink some fundamental aspect about the way you approach your work? I see Sydney.
When I was teaching, but an artist friend who I'd met at a science art conference said something that really staggered me. He said, you scientists are so hung up on being right. That was just like running into a brick wall.
Yeah.
I think you would have enjoyed meeting this guy because you would have had a good conversation with him. Just the idea that you shouldn't make being right a central issue just blew me apart.
That's really amazing to have it articulated.
Yeah.
I have to say I had an aha moment like this. I taught a film class and we had to make a production in 6 hours or 8 hours, which is very, very tight, and they were all ages. It was from 8-year-olds till 14-year-olds. And the only way I could handle the idea of getting something done so fast was pretty much to let them self-regulate their process and just give them broad, a tool, an object, and tell them to assign, to create a group to deal with 6 plans and to pick a director. Or not to pick, they didn't pick anything. Someone would just become a director. I mean, I was so out of control with these kids, and they just did it. It was absolutely amazing to me. They organized themselves, they gave they put the little kids in proper roles. They applied the one single cinematic tool I gave them. They filmed it. They scripted it. They had a director. It's one of the most charming things that I've seen my classes produce. And I really didn't have much to do with it. So the idea of self-regulation is really uncomfortable when you are the primary. If you're the artist. The idea that the people you're hiring to work for you or the people who are involved in your project are not going to bother consulting you is truly terrifying, and I couldn't go near it as an artist, but I think I'm missing out on something.
The only thing that comes to mind when I first started teaching dance when I was 14, so very young, my dad really encouraged this entrepreneurial idea in us. Anyway, one of my students, I remember saying to her mother after one of the recitals that she was getting so good, she was going to surpass me. And I said it in a way that, you know, I was immature and I felt threatened by it, I guess. And she said, well, that should be your goal, right? Mm-hmm. And oh my God, yes, that should be my goal. And that was very humbling to be called out on that.
Yeah. Well, you were 14.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think about if there's something in the way that in my teaching that has changed the way I do my science. And I don't really think so, but I think certainly teaching has helped me put my science in a bigger context and to think about it and to be able to communicate it and talk about it with people that are not, you know, PhDs in taste as well. Yeah. And so I think that's actually really helpful because then I can be more effective at hopefully communicating to you why what I'm doing is important or interesting because I know it is, but it's my job to kind of communicate that to you or to, you know, my students. And so I think it's certainly, I mean, science is so big and it's so overwhelming and there's so much information out there that, you know, I can't know the percentage of information out there. So, you know, maybe I know less than 1% of the information that's out there. But, you know, professors 50 years ago, they could know a lot of stuff, right? They knew 50, 60% of the science that was out there because it has just escalated off the charts over the last 30 or 40 years. And so they were very broadly trained and they had very broad perspectives. And so the downside of having so much information that people have to really specialize is they can become very narrow in their thinking because you can't know everything about everything. And so stepping back and thinking about how I can make this information relatable or how we can talk about it, I think also just kind of helps you stop and put it in perspective a little bit. And that's important to always kind of, for I think everybody, but certainly for scientists, to like kind of stop and think about why, you know, why is this? I mean, we just want to know the answer, but we also need to kind of put it in the bigger context, and that helps us get to the better answer or the right answer. So.
Wow.
If you all have questions, feel free to, you know, write them down and share them. Otherwise, I will keep asking my questions. I want to go maybe move to a more of a macro level. What concerns do you have about education in the United States?
I want to speak on that.
You heard mine. You heard mine.
I think that critical to it is the lack of money that we put into it and the lack of respect. We owe so much more to the children of the world, to the children of this country, and to the people that teach them than constantly trying to find ways to pinch, financially pinch them. So,
That was really well said. I can't add much to that.
I guess the thing to me is just the lack of equal opportunity. So I'm at a university in Buffalo, New York, which is one of the, I mean, we don't actually in Buffalo, but Buffalo itself is one of the poorest cities in the country. And the appalling school situation for all of those children, it's like, it's amazing that anyone ever gets out of poverty when they're in those kinds of situations, much less survive through it, right? And the dropout rates, you know, 50 or 60%. I mean, it made the night, I was thinking about when I was on this food panel the other day with Ann Cooper talking about all this organic stuff she's making for the kids' school, which is fantastic. And it's like, it made the nightly news when somebody drove a little truck down into Buffalo City so the 7-Eleven could sell apples and bananas because 7-Elevens and convenience stores are the only grocery stores that people down there have, and they have no access to fresh fruit. And a lot of those kids in schools don't even know what a potato is if they bring in real food to show them. And it's like, so you think, how can anyone survive that, much less get out and make a contribution to the world? Yeah. And so I think it's that lack of equal opportunity that's in this country. That's just, that's I think the worst part of it. If we could even out the resources,
Because there's a lot of money spent on education in New York, but I'm not exactly sure
where it's going.
Well,
we have state think it's all going to the city, but I'm not so sure about that. Maybe.
Yeah, you know.
But they still have too little money for their schools.
They do, right. Yeah. But in Buffalo, because it's kind of an immigrant town, we have like 52 languages taught in that school because there's so many kids coming in that can't speak English.
Yeah.
And so then you think all of these things that just slow everything down. So that's what I think is the worst part.
Well, also there's that thing with the that we're always bumping financial responsibility back.